Our guest this hour writes in The Atlantic that since the 1995 publication of Daniel Goleman's bestseller, Emotional Intelligence, it's been touted by leaders, policymakers, and educators as the solution to a wide range of social problems. If we can teach our children to manage emotions, we'll have less bullying, more cooperation. If we can cultivate emotional intelligence among leaders and doctors, we'll have more caring workplaces and more compassionate health care. It is important, our guest says, but the unbridled enthusiasm has obscured a dark side. When people hone their emotional skills, they become better at manipulating others. Our guest this hour is Professor Adam Grant. He is the author of The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence, which appears in The Atlantic, and also author of Give and Take, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcoming phone calls for him, and we'll also be listening to some examples of emotional intelligence at work in leaders we all know, some using it for good and some using it for ill. So stay tuned for that. Welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And I'm particularly interested in hearing from educators, and people in workplaces who are using emotional intelligence and learning about emotional intelligence. How is it playing out in your workplace? I think it's interesting. Professor Adam Grant, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be back in the Midwest.
Yeah, nice to have you here. For those who kind of missed this whole discussion about emotional intelligence, give me a definition.
Well, emotional intelligence is a set of abilities about recognizing, understanding, and managing emotions. So when somebody has a facial expression that looks like anger, can you spot it? Do you know what caused it? And then are you able to regulate or manage your own anger and also talk that person off the ledge?
Hmm. And it became a huge thing in the country with the publication of that book. When you write in your article that it's been touted by all of these people, by educators and business people and policymakers, what are they all doing? Setting up courses on emotional intelligence?
Yeah, there are many courses. In a lot of cases, this is required for leadership development. There are some business schools that use it even for admissions, trying to figure out how emotionally intelligent candidates are.
Really?
Yeah, and you know, I think in many ways it's a step in the right direction, right? Because success in work and in life is a lot more than just your cognitive abilities. But sometimes we overlook the dark side, and my goal was really to make sure that we had a really balanced understanding of both the good and the evil.
Mm-hmm. So the dark side is that it can be used to manipulate others. Elaborate, please.
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about emotional intelligence as a set of skills for, you know, really shaping the emotions not only that you feel, but also the emotions that other people feel, oftentimes leaders who are self-serving, who are manipulative, are able to use their knowledge of emotions to take advantage of others. There's a powerful set of studies led by Jochen Menges at the University of Cambridge. And what they do is they have leaders give speeches that are filled with emotions and designed to inspire. And the more emotionally compelling a speech is, the less the audience actually really carefully evaluates the message. And you get moved by that speech to the point where you're awestruck. I actually think it's more like being dumbstruck because you claim to remember the speech really well, but objectively on a memory test, you remember less of it because you were so bowled over by the emotion in the message.
Hmm. Well, let's listen. And this isn't even in English, but we'll get a sense of what you're talking about by listening to this famous figure in history who really, and we'll hear more about this, masterfully studied gestures and speaking ability and did just what our guest has described. You may not understand what he's saying, but you'll get the emotion here.
Sie ist mehr als ein Almosen. Wenn wir sagen, nicht den Reichen, gebt ihr den Armen, sondern wir sagen, deutsches Volk, hilft ihr selbst. Jeder soll helfen, ob arm oder reich. Jeder soll sich denken, es gibt noch einen, der ärmer ist als ich.
As you may imagine, that is Hitler, and you can hear the applause in the background. I guess I wasn't very aware that he really made a science of studying emotions and hand gestures and voice and all of that to be able to move people to an abhorrent point of view.
That's right. It's actually something that I became aware of only after asking questions for years in class. You know, to ask our MBA students at Wharton, when you think of leaders who have had a lot of influence, who comes to mind? And more often than not, there's somebody in the room who will mention Hitler. And so, you know, obviously we violently object to the way that influence was exercised in that case. But from the standpoint of studying leadership, it's an example worth understanding. How is he able to move so many people? And it does turn out that he spent years studying his body language and what kind of emotional effects it had. So he had his hand gestures photographed, and he would look at them to try to figure out what is the most spellbinding movement that he can make at a given moment to really emphasize his message.
Hmm. And how do you determine that? If you're using this for ill, to manipulate people, do you practice it on people to see if they agree with what you have to say, or how do you even know that, the answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what happens in some of these cases is you have a test audience, right? You give a practice speech. You convey a message, you observe the reaction, and then you ask, how did you respond? And you can start to differentiate a little bit, okay, what are the more effective and less effective ways to really both express and cultivate emotion?
Hmm. Well, forgive my questioning about this whole thing, but there is a way, at least for me, to look at this and to say that a lot of this emotional intelligence may be used for our own personal gain. Is that a fair criticism, or are there people who are learning emotional intelligence to benefit others?
Well, you definitely find a mix of the two. And the reason I ended up writing this article, actually, was my book, Give and Take, came out last year. And it's about how there are these differences in style between what I call takers, who are always trying to get as much as possible from others, and givers who enjoy helping others and often do it without any strings attached.
Hmm.
And you know, I would speak about these styles, and there's a third, which is most of us, we're matchers. We interact with others expecting an even balance of give and take, quid pro quo. But I would speak about these ideas while I was on tour, and people would always ask, well, is part of being a giver having high emotional intelligence? And the answer is no, because you know, whether you tend to be a giver or a taker is about your motivation. It's your intention toward other people. And emotional intelligence is this skill set that, you know, can be applied by takers in a self-serving way or giving, you know, givers in a way that's much more about trying to help and benefit others. And the good news is there are lots of givers who, as part of the process of attempting to support and contribute to others, work on honing their understanding of what emotions other people are feeling so that they can tailor the support they provide more effectively.
Mm. Well, you say in the article there is growing recognition that, like any skill, emotional intelligence can be used for good or evil. If we're going to teach it in schools and develop it at work, we need to consider the values that go along with it and whether it's actually useful. What kinds of values?
Well, I think that in a lot of cases, when we teach emotional intelligence, we just assume that if you recognize other people's emotions, you will automatically empathize and feel concern and compassion. But that doesn't happen just all of a sudden, right? You have to learn to not only recognize other people's emotions, but appreciate their importance. And so I guess the first set of values that I would be interested in teaching is what are often called by psychologists universalism values. So we all, as kids growing up, learn the importance of sharing and caring, but we tend to learn that in a pretty parochial way. We learn to be concerned about our in-group, our family, our friends, maybe our community members. And, you know, in most cases, schools don't succeed in actually teaching children to care about people who are members of different kinds of out-groups, whether that's a different race or a different country or even a different occupation. And so, you know, I think getting people to expand their circle of concern is probably a first step.
Right. How is emotional intelligence, I don't know if you're teaching it at the University of Pennsylvania, but when I read that it's being taught widely at schools and also, I guess, in various businesses, how do you teach emotional intelligence?
Well, I think usually, so I teach it to our MBA students, And a lot of what I do is informed by a colleague, Sigal Barsad, who's one of the world's leading experts in this area. And, you know, what I've learned from Sigal is that awareness is usually the first step. So if you want people to become more emotionally intelligent and use the skill, you've got to first impart the knowledge of how to do it. So one component of what we teach is actually about how to recognize emotions. So it turns out there's a series of emotions that have universal facial expressions. Surprise, disgust, contempt, all look the same from one culture to another. And so if you learn the facial cues associated with those expressions, you can become a little bit better at then reading what other people are feeling.
Mm-hmm.
A second component then we look at is how do you understand what's causing people to feel certain emotions? So I spent some time, for example, teaching the difference between guilt and shame, which a lot of people just confuse or assume are the same thing. And, you know, there what we would do is say, look, actually, when you look at the data, shame is an emotion that you feel when you think you're a bad person. Guilt is an emotion you feel when you think you did a bad thing.
Mm.
And, you know, again, that understanding tends to help you figure out, okay, what kind of reaction am I producing in others? And then the last part that we probably spend the most time on is the regulating and managing piece. So when you have what often gets called an amygdala hijacking, where, you know, you're seeing red and you're completely overwhelmed by usually anger, but sometimes fear, how do you then override that emotion? And we look at what are effective techniques, what are less effective techniques, and then students have a chance to actually practice them.
Mm-hmm. Would you say there are a lot of politicians around today who make it a serious study, emotional intelligence?
Absolutely. You could call it politician training 101 in many cases.
And they do that in order to get people to vote for them?
Yeah, I mean, what works better in terms of getting votes than to have people connect with you emotionally?
Right. Set up this other thing that we're going to hear. You, in your article, talk about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech to illustrate the power, and oh, was he a powerful speaker, the power that an emotionally intelligent speaker can have. Set it up, and then we're going to hear a part of that speech.
Well, I think what I found just so powerful about the I Have a Dream speech is the ability of Dr. King, in that case, to stir the hearts of the audience. And a lot of that is about the use of imagery and metaphor to bring the ideas to life. So, you know, he was not only able to say, look, we want to really create an opportunity for everybody to be treated equally, but he painted a picture. He talked about sons of former slaves and former slave owners sitting together on the red hills of Georgia. And, you know, you can see that, right? You can almost touch it and feel it and taste it.
And here is part of that speech.
It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
So when you write in your article in The Atlantic that he chose language that would stir the hearts of his audience, and I guess you could add, have people think about what is right and what is wrong and how history has hurt people and how the future can help people, there can be absolutely the best of motives in using emotional intelligence.
That's right. I, the best analysis that I've read is from Nancy Duarte at Duarte Design, who has actually charted what goes on moment to moment in this speech. And one of the things she points out is that there's this very powerful back and forth between what is and what could be. Yeah, the what is basically deep-seated frustration and even righteous indignation at the status quo, right? That a wrong has been perpetrated. But there's also this tremendous amount of hope and passion about the future, that there's an alternative way to organize society and for people to live. And it's really first destabilizing the status quo and, you know, really cultivating that strong dissatisfaction around saying, look, you know, it's not acceptable to continue as we were, and then painting the picture of the alternate reality in a way. And what I think is so amazing about that is you can hear the passion in his voice, but you can also just imagine all the different emotions that he was feeling, and to be able to keep that in balance so that, as Clarence Jones, his speechwriter, wrote, it was reason and emotion, anger and hope. Yeah, I think to do that required just extraordinary skill.
Mm-hmm. And I think at one point in the article, you say that people in the workplace who have been taught emotional intelligence in the best way are much more effective at channeling their anger and letting superiors know about certain issues and being able to be calm about their presentation of their concerns.
That's right. It's obviously a much more mundane, everyday example.
Yeah, but for most of us.
It's something that I've studied recently. I was working with a healthcare company, and one of their goals was to encourage employees to speak up and voice ideas and suggestions. And this is something that a lot of people hold back on, right? They don't want to be labeled as a whistleblower or as a complainer or just as somebody who rocks the boat too much. And so the question there was then, well, what does it take for employees to speak up? And what I found was, employees who had higher emotional intelligence, as reported on a knowledge test where we looked at, do they recognize what are good strategies for managing and regulating emotions, they actually spoke up more. They were more likely to challenge the status quo. They were more willing to make suggestions for improvement that might not be popular but were quite important. And the way that they did that was through two techniques that are known as surface acting and deep acting. So surface acting is basically putting on a mask and saying, look, you know, I may be feeling a lot of anxiety about really challenging my boss, but I'm going to express enthusiasm or concern to try to cover up the anxiety that I'm feeling. And then deep acting is actually the more powerful strategy. It's saying, instead of just putting on a particular expression, I'm going to change the emotion that I'm feeling. So what the really emotionally intelligent employees did was, before they were going to go in and pitch an idea that might not be so popular, they would actually think about a different experience that might calm them down. Or they might actually try to imagine a group of supporters who are going to react enthusiastically to the idea so that they could come in without cracking their voices too much. And it seemed to work quite well, because the emotionally intelligent people who spoke up not only were more likely to speak up, but they got more favorable evaluations when they did it. So their bosses gave them higher performance ratings.
Hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. Adam Grant is our guest. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and wrote an interesting piece in The Atlantic, The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence. He's also the author of Give and Take. He writes that some of the greatest moments in human history were fueled by emotional intelligence. We played one of Dr. Martin Luther King's, part of his I Have a Dream speech, but there can also be a dark side to this as well. Delivering his speech, Dr. King had an electrifying message that required the ability to recognize, understand, and manage emotions. But there are others who have the ability to rob us of our capacity to reason, using their emotional intelligence for all the worst reasons, which also begs the question, why are we taken for such a ride? What's in it that makes us so easily manipulated? Maybe we need a course in that. We welcome your phone calls. What do you teach? I don't know anybody who teaches emotional intelligence, but evidently it's being taught in schools and in businesses. So please let me know what's going on in that area and how it's being used in the workplace and how it's being used politically. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Let's start with Mike in Madison. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I was just calling to see if your guest had ever heard the Riverside speech by Martin Luther King. It was at a Riverside church, I think, in New York. But it was about poverty and militarism and how much we spent on the Vietnam War at the time and that it should have been going to. It said they had, there are three evils, one being militarism and two, capitalism. I can't remember what the third one was, but that really struck me.
Would you like to respond, emotional intelligence, in that speech, Adam?
Yeah, it's a speech, obviously, that's not as well known as the I Have a Dream speech. But as I recall it anyway, I think that, you know, there are a number of really interesting examples of emotion. First of all, you know, I think Dr. King is, in that case, very clearly able to rely on, you know, the history of being a preacher. And so it's possible to be able to talk about, you know, look, not just the sort of the, I guess, the secular reasons that a cause is important societally, but also to be able to speak from a religious standpoint. And I think the speech had a lot of power for that reason. You know, I think there's a very, very strong moral appeal here where he basically responded to some possible counterarguments. The quote that stands out in my mind was when he said, "For those who ask the question, aren't you a civil rights leader, and therefore mean to exclude me from the movement for peace?" His response was, you know, basically, look, if you care about American life, then peace is part of a civil rights cause. And I think, you know, he's able to, in that case, reframe his contribution in such a way that people can follow along with the importance, again, from an emotional standpoint, of this cause to him and to everybody in this country. And I think it's another very, very interesting example that probably deserves a closer look.
Let's go to Devin in Milwaukee. Hello, Devin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm a social worker in Milwaukee, and I work with young adults who have aged out of the foster care system, many who survived a lot of trauma and neglect in their lifetime, and we are a trauma-informed care agency that I work with, and we see a lot of young people that their state in terms of, you know, arousal continuum is always sort of at a heightened state rather than a lot of us who are able to be at a calmer state. And so their emotional intelligence gets affected a lot of times that way. And we work with them on learning some skills to work on adjusting that and building up some skills like that. And we've learned that a lot of repetition and rhythm type exercises, like dribbling a basketball over and over, or doing things with music in the background to create sort of a harmony, can help.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I was wondering if the caller had any thoughts on that. Or
I'm sure he does. That's very interesting. Adam?
Yeah, you know, it is very interesting. It's not something that I've read a lot of research on. I think that, you know, my general reaction is to say that when it comes to developing emotional intelligence in a trauma setting, which is extremely important, on the patient side, there's a book called Redirect by Timothy Wilson, who reports some pretty disturbing evidence showing that after September 11th, there were a lot of trauma counselors who, you know, immediately started doing sort of post-traumatic stress debriefing and trying to help people make sense of the events. And the data show that not only did that do no good, it appeared to actually backfire and do some harm.
Really?
Yeah, and the prevailing explanation, although it's something that deserves a lot more research, is that people need time to process these events before they can start to find, you know, if not a silver lining, in a lot of cases that's not possible, at least some coherence to make sense of it and be able to think about it and reason about it, as opposed to just experience the strong and intense emotions. And so there seems to be an optimal time to intervene, which is usually not right away.
Hmm. Oh, that's it. That's interesting, too. Thanks, Devin, very much for the call. Mary, Madison, hello.
Hello. Just a quick comment. I think the most persuasive language is found in the Bible, especially with Christ encountering with the coin of Caesar. But my question was Goebbels, he was influenced by an American who had written a book in the 1920s for business people about persuasion and that sort of thing.
Do you know that book?
Off the top of my head, I don't. Is there a question to follow it?
Did you have a question, Mary?
Well, Goebbels was influenced by him, and I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
Yeah, maybe another listener knows more about that story. I'm sure somebody out there does know more. Let's go back to being used for ill, though, because she brought up Goebbels, which makes you think of Hitler again. And I want to talk about what it is when this is being used for ill and sometimes for horror, what it is that allows those listeners to the misuse, the manipulation of emotional intelligence to fall under a kind of spell and lose all ability to reason and to do the right thing.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think it's something that we're beginning to understand probably not nearly as well as we ought to. But I would say a couple things. The first thing is that, you know, a lot of people think that thinking and feeling are two independent modes. And they largely are in many ways. Most of us have both those capabilities, luckily. But they're very hard to use at the exact same moment. So if you're overwhelmed by an intense emotion, it's hard to override that with reason. It's hard to step out of you know, feeling the passion of somebody's speech or, you know, sort of sharing in the anger that's being expressed. And while you're feeling that, at the same time say, all right, let me think about the pros and cons of this speech. There's some research by Dan Gilbert at Harvard who shows that when people are facing, you know, sort of intense demands on their attention, they actually can't process an argument without believing it. And so, you know, if you're really intently listening to a speaker and it's got a lot of emotion in the message, then part of what's happening is as you hear it, you're accepting the premise is true as you're going about sort of internalizing it. And then it's a whole other mental process to step back and say, all right, but is this true? Mm-hmm. When might it be false? And that turns out to be a lot harder than many people expect.
Hmm. Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest saw himself or knew of any studies that took up the issue of either a correlation or a coincidental effect between a sense of humor and emotional intelligence. And one other question I have for him is, today we're hearing more and more about rapid diagnosis of autism in the population, which seems to be a loss of connection between people. I'm wondering if he has any observations on that as well.
Yeah, let me tackle the first question. The second question is outside of my expertise. But on the first, is there a relationship between humor and emotional intelligence? There's a book that actually is going to reveal the answer to that conveniently comes out on April Fool's Day. It's called The Humor Code. It's by Peter McGraw and Joel Warner, a psychologist and a journalist who partnered up traveling around the world to figure out, are there any global rules for what makes things funny? And it's one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. I had a chance to read an advanced copy over the fall. And after I read it, I said, my gosh, I wish I wrote this book. And one of the things they tackle is humor a sign of intelligence? If so, what kind of intelligence? Is it about your cognitive ability? Is it emotional intelligence? Is it some of both?
Hmm. What's the name of it?
The Humor Code.
The Humor Code. Okay. Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. Joe in Prairie du Chien, hi.
Hi. I'm curious how emotional intelligence would play into theater and cinema. Assuming it's a valid reason for some of these people that we know, you know, Brando, Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep and all that. They must have a fairly strong ability in this area.
Yeah, I think acting is a domain probably that requires as much emotional intelligence as any other field. You know, I always think of Daniel Day-Lewis as the prime example of this. So most recently in preparing for Lincoln, you know, going off and disappearing for months.
Yes.
You know, only communicating basically in Lincoln's voice. You know, actually living in the kind of log cabin, you know, that was probably pretty typical for an upbringing in that era, to really internalize the role, so that, you know, he could not only understand the character intellectually, but actually feel the day-to-day emotions of what it was like to be in that position. And I think that's fascinating.
Mm. And it also, when you were talking about 9/11 responders are trying to, when somebody's caught in an emotional state, that it's hard to be reasonable. That can happen in movies, too. You know, I frequently go to a movie that's so moving to me, and who I'm with will say, well, let's talk about the movie. I said, no, I can't talk about it right now, because you're carried off to another place, and you just simply don't want to break it down and analyze it.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
No, I think that a lot of what actors do, you know, which requires emotional intelligence, goes back to this idea of deep acting that we mentioned before. In acting or in theater, it's called method acting,
right,
often, and it's the idea of actually internalizing and becoming the character, so that, you know, you're not just pretending to be that person, but you're actually trying to feel what mm-hmm. that character would feel, mm-hmm. so that then what you express comes out as more authentic and more genuine. And the interesting thing is the evidence on this, there's over a decade of research now on how people do this in the workplace, because we all have moments where we have to act, suggests that if you get really good at deep acting, at feeling what you want to express, that it's actually less stressful and you're less likely to burn out if you're in a job like customer service, where you have to do a lot of that being on stage.
Hmm. But you also point in the article to, I can't remember what company it was, where you are taught the technique of crying will be good to get people to contribute to some kind of charity, but better yet is to cry at a certain point in the presentation.
Yeah, that was at the Body Shop from Anita Roddick. And, you know, it is very interesting that part of being trained at many organizations, especially customer-facing organizations, is learning rules about emotion expressions. A couple of colleagues have studied this for many years, Bob Sutton and Anat Raffaelli, and they've written quite eloquently about all the different emotion rules that organizations develop for what's the right emotion to show, when do you express it, to whom should you express it, how long do you want to have it last. And Bob Sutton did one study that really stood out for me, where he looked at bill collectors and, you know, wanted to know, most of the time we think that people are having to fake positive emotions when they don't feel it. You know, think about your stereotypical example of a flight attendant, for example, when dealing with a really angry or belligerent passenger and, you know, sort of maintaining service with a smile. What Sutton found really interesting is, you know, as a bill collector, you have to do the opposite. So, you might not be feeling the negativity that you're expected to express, whether that's anger or disappointment or frustration. And how do people sort of psych themselves up to do that?
Hmm. Thanks very much, Joe. Interesting area to bring us into. Gino in Sussex, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I was thinking of a different speech that Bobby Kennedy had said. I believe it was at the NAACP, the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and how he diffused that crowd.
It was,
it was one of the only major
right.
cities that did not riot.
It was Indianapolis, and he spoke in the central city. Bodyguards advised him not to go there, and he just, that is one remarkable speech. I don't know if he used it. The other thing that I wonder about, the quality of just being genuine when you speak, because he drew upon history and Aeschylus, I believe, in presenting that speech, but there was also something really genuine about it. I understand, and people could understand it because he had lived through assassination of his brother, and somehow he was able to calm Indianapolis, where there weren't any riots after the assassination. Was that a use of emotional intelligence, or was that just a man speaking totally from the heart, and is there a difference?
Yeah, there is a difference, actually. So one of the points that we make when we teach emotional intelligence in a business school setting is authenticity is the critical driver of, you know, whether it quote-unquote works. You know, if people perceive you as insincere, then you lose credibility really quickly. And so not only do you need to figure out what are the right emotions to express and to try to cultivate, but how am I going to do that in a way that is actually consistent with my values, my character, and who I'm perceived to be. And, you know, I do think that there's, you know, if you take the Kennedy speech as an example, there is emotional intelligence required, right, in two ways. One is, you know, figuring out which authentic emotions to express. You know, after an assassination, especially one of such an important figure and one that hits so close to home from personal experience, you know, you have to imagine that there's a mix of emotions that are occurring. And some of those are going to be more appropriate to express than others. You know, you can be authentic without expressing everything that you're feeling. Mm-hmm. And then the other part is how do you then sort of transfer what you're feeling in such a way that people can relate to it, having not been through an assassination themselves? And, you know, I think that requires the ability to really imagine what other people are going to feel in response to what you say and making sure that you can convey that in a way that it is relatable.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up that speech. You know, I think it was a very important one, and it's very moving. Carol in Oak Creek, hello.
Hi, thank you. Don't you think advertisers have emotional intelligence down to a science? You know, buy our product and you'll feel great. I think we're manipulated by advertisers daily. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. And there's a nice body of research on this that shows that most of us get wiser over time. We develop persuasion knowledge so that we know what kinds of cues are used against us, and then we put up our guard. I was thinking of most recently of the Apple commercial as a really interesting example of advertisers using emotions, where you see it was around the holiday time for those of you who didn't see it, and you catch a kid at basically at Christmas who looks like he's really disengaged, he's quiet, he's withdrawn, and he's just constantly on his phone. And, you know, you have that visceral reaction of, oh, no, you know, the rise in technology has led kids to alienate themselves from their families. And then you see that he's actually videotaping the series of family events and creating a video for the whole family to watch and take joy in. And, you know, it's a really powerful example of emotion because you shift very quickly from feeling some degree of frustration to all of a sudden this sense of surprise and then a little bit of elation. and then you start to wonder, well, do I really even want to feel that in response to an advertisement?
Right. Thank you, Carol, very much. More phone calls in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. Adam Grant is our guest. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and has a piece in The Atlantic, The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence. He's also author of Give and Take, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Gary in Duluth next. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I had a good friend of mine one time who told me, he said, sincerity sells. And when you've learned to fake sincerity, you've got it made.
Right.
And my problem with quote-unquote sincerity is a person can be truly sincere in their belief system, but their belief system itself can be totally irrational. And if a person is responding simply to the sincerity rather than to what's being said, a lot of people can be, they just are not going to, you know, think about what's going down as far as what this person is putting forward.
Professor Grant.
You know, it's something that I find really tricky to analyze. In part, there's a classic book by Lionel Trilling called Sincerity and Authenticity, where he argues actually that authenticity and sincerity are two different things, and that being authentic is about being true to yourself, however other people might disagree with your principles or your values, whereas sincerity is sort of an older idea of being sort of a person of moral character and of concern for others. And Trilling makes the case that you actually can't fake sincerity, that sincerity is inherently other-oriented, whereas authenticity can be sort of embraced in a way that other people find deeply offensive and in some cases even harmful. And so, you know, I guess I would say that you could fake authenticity and maybe have it made. It's harder to fake sincerity.
Let's listen to another politician who has been considered to be a fine orator and at times extraordinarily fine orator, and then we'll find out what Adam thinks about his use of emotional intelligence, the techniques that are apparent to him in this speech.
For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family.
Adam Grant, your analysis.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like President Obama at the Democratic National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there are so many compelling uses of emotion there. I guess the first thing I would say is one of the markers of emotional intelligence in a persuasive speech is recognizing that it's very difficult to change people's values and much easier to appeal to values they already hold. And here, the idea that we're all connected as one people is, you know, part of the American dream, right? That you come to this country. And regardless of what your origin or your previous opportunities are, that you can achieve your goals. And I think, you know, sort of making that ideal the focus of the speech, obviously, really, it stirs up a lot of emotion for many people. And it's very interesting because different leaders have different ways of doing that. And, you know, to pick an example from the other side of the political debate, there's a wonderful analysis in Dan Pink's book, To Sell as Human, of the sort of the Ronald Reagan question of, instead of saying, you know, I know that you're not better off today than you were 4 years ago, he asks a question and says, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And what's nice about a question as a persuasive device is that people fill in the answers for themselves. And the state of the economy was such that people were going to answer that question, no. I'm not better off than I was 4 years ago, and it's a lot easier then to let people feel the emotion on their own terms than to try to sell it to them. And, you know, I think in both of those cases, you see different strategies at play, but the same idea is to appeal to that value that is already held as opposed to trying to change a value.
Yeah. Patrick, Janesville.
Hi. I was just going to say there was a lady that called in, was asking about a certain person that influenced Goebbels, and I have to wonder if she was referring to Edward Bernays, that he was from the business community and seemed like he understood how to get into people's minds, as it were, to sell them things, because I know that's part of the what a couple other callers were talking about. So that I guess that was just my comment.
All right, thanks. And somebody else. And I'm sorry.
I actually wondered about Bernays as well. He wrote about the engineering of consent, and it's basically a study of how to manipulate people. And obviously very popular a little over half a century ago when it came to sort of informing and shaping how people tried to gain public favor or influence public opinion. I don't know if that was the answer or not, but it's certainly one of the earlier and more powerful analyses of last century of how people manipulate, and emotions are a big part of it.
Mm. Thanks, Patrick. Jim, Mount Horeb, hello.
Yes, I missed the beginning. I would be interested in your guests talking about in public speech the response that audiences give emotionally. For instance, Martin Luther King and just about every politician will have their sideman sort of cheering them on, and there are also the responses of the audience. So if he could talk about that.
All right, Jim.
Yeah, my favorite look at this is in Influence by Robert Cialdini. Cialdini spent the past 3 decades studying how people exercise influence and persuade others to change their minds and their beliefs and their behaviors. And there's a chapter in Influence on Social Proof where he points out that when we're facing uncertainty, we follow the lead of similar others. And that instinctively, when we're sitting in an audience or a crowd and other people respond and we're uncertain about how to respond, we tend to tilt in the direction that they have. This is why, for example, sitcoms continue to use laugh tracks, even though a lot of people claim to find them annoying, because even if you say you don't like them, hearing other people laugh at a joke is one of the cues that you ought to laugh too, and people actually will report that the same show is funnier when there's a laugh track attached than when it's not. If you ask them, is that true, they'll say no, but when you test their actual, you know, response to the humor that shows up. And you know, I think having a group of yes men cheer for you is one of the easiest ways to elicit that kind of reaction. But if it goes too far, of course, it backfires. So, you know, if there's cheering at a point that doesn't have any emotion attached to it, people will start to notice the discrepancy, and so that's got to be carefully planned and well timed for it to have the desired effect.
And thank you very much for your call. Tell me, you are a professor of business. Tell me how extensively emotional intelligence is being used, maybe in areas we haven't yet discussed, Adam, in the business community.
Well, I see it all the time when I work with both students and leaders and executives. Everyone has read Daniel Goleman's bestseller. Many people have been to emotional intelligence training courses. Hmm. And what's interesting is, in many cases, the cart is before the horse, in the sense that we know a lot now about what emotional intelligence is, what are the kinds of parenting practices that develop it. We also know a fair amount now about the consequences of it, but there's very little research on how you actually train it and increase it. And so many of the training courses that are out there are basically built on an assumption that if you do raise people's awareness, that they will be able to take the knowledge that they have and put it into action. We don't always know if that's true. And there are times when awareness works. There are times when you can know exactly what the proper emotional response is in a situation and choose to ignore it. I think that's something that I'd love to see more attention to in the business community is how do we translate the knowledge into a set of actual skills that people can utilize every day.
And what would you like to see in the intellectual community in schools?
Well, I think in a school setting, I would like to see, building on what we talked about earlier, I'd like to see some attention to effective and ineffective uses of emotions that touches on not just, what is the emotion that's going to influence people, but also what is the way to express and manage emotions to benefit others. I'd love to see some attention, for example, to teaching as much as possible, to go beyond perspective taking, to empathy, to not only understand mm-hmm. what your fellow classmates are thinking, but actually feel what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we taught that super well, but there is a really nice way to do it that Elliot Aronson created, actually in the wake of Texas desegregation in about 1970. It's called the Jigsaw Classroom, and what Aronson does is group students together. It's usually a group of four, let's say in an elementary school. You're going to do a book report on a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. And each student is responsible for learning a different part of her life and then teaching that to the rest of the group. And he finds that when students have to collaborate interdependently toward a common goal so that they're each a piece of a jigsaw puzzle, that they actually become less prejudiced. They use stereotypes less to understand each other, and they're a lot more likely then to identify and to really connect. And I think it would be great to have more jigsaw classroom-like projects so that students learn to really feel the emotions of their peers.
Hmm. Well, Adam, thank you very much for being with us. We had a good time. Thanks. Adam Grant, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His article is in The Atlantic, and it's on our Facebook page in case you'd like to read it. It's The Kathleen Dunn Show. The article is titled The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence, and he's also the author of a book released last year, Give and Take. Thanks to Judith Sears Poisson for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production. Monday, we'll be with you. Our All Things Political will probably be a little bit late. Monday is the MLK 34th tribute and ceremony at noon, and we'll be airing it here on the Ideas Network. We'll celebrate his life and legacy, words, music. It's the 34th annual tribute and ceremony at the State Capitol Rotunda in Madison. The celebration of this year is We Shall Not Be Moved. The host is Jonathan Overby, so you're invited to listen to that, and then we will join you after that ceremony for some talk about Dr. Martin Luther King and in all things political. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.